Tonight on Arena, Steven Spielberg's E.T. is 40, and new albums from George Ezra, Sinead O'Brien and Vance Joy up for review. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Years ago this month saw the release of Steven Spielberg's E.T., the extraterrestrial film about a stranded alien, a boy called Elliot who discovers it, and a bond of friendship that remains as heartbreaking today as it was back in 1982. Aided by John Williams' score, which we were just listening to, and performances from then-child actors Drew Barrymore and Henry Thomas, the film soared to become the highest grossing film of the year, capturing 4 Academy Awards, 9 Oscar nominations, including Best Picture, and has endured as a universal favourite in the decades since. With me in studio this evening to talk about all things E.T. is John Maguire. And now, John, rewind the clock 4 decades, please.
I know, yeah.
I want the young John Maguire. Yeah. I want him sitting in the Ashling Cinema in Ballinasloe.
That's right.
What is he doing and what is he seeing?
Well, he's crying his eyes out. First of all, I wept. I cried myself dry, Sean. It was E.T. was an emotional, a cathartic emotional outburst for the whole planet, I have to say. Everybody cried.
Everybody in the cinema was crying. How do you know everybody was crying?
Because I turned around at a key moment, at the point where little E.T., the extraterrestrial, points his long glowing finger at the boy Elliot's heart and he croaks his goodbye, "I'll be right here." And I turned around right at that moment and all you could see, like a spray of diamonds across a jeweler's mat, it was just wet tears reflected from the screen. A sea of faces. Everybody was in floods
men,
of tears.
Men, women,
it's
children.
One of my earliest clear, it's exactly men, women and children. It's one of my earliest cinema memories and I have a very clear recollection of it because it was heartbreaking, Sean. Yeah. It was utterly heartbreaking. Now, we had been, this was the winter of 1983. This would be in early January. Yeah. The film was released here in December. But the Americans had been watching it for 6 months. That's how they used to do it. The American releases wouldn't
the
get
big summer blockbuster.
For about 6 months. And it had been a huge blockbuster. So we'd had 6 months of E.T. at that stage. We'd been fed E.T. It was on our cornflakes packets. You could get, the Maxall garage would give you a little E.T. toy if you filled your tank. We knew who E.T. was. And we still weren't ready for just the dam burst.
I mean, when you think of the premise, an alien comes to Earth and becomes friends with a little boy.
Yeah,
at one level, it's the simplest of stories out there.
Exactly.
But what's going on behind all of that?
Well, it's that two kindred souls, the lonely boy named Elliot, living somewhere in California. We guess it's Los Angeles. We can see the lights. And he's dealing with his parents' divorce. And that's key to the understanding of the film and Spielberg's motivation for writing the film with Melissa Matheson in the first place. And this little alien becomes accidentally stranded. He's on a botanical mission. There's a vegetarian species of aliens. Then they're checking out the plants. The rest of them leave. E.T. is left behind and he's desperate to get back to his own planet. And together with his friends and families, the boy must find a way to help this helpless creature while avoiding the U.S. government, who are on the case and giving chase. And ultimately, the film is about two lost children longing for the comfort and safety of home, who rescue one another through the power of love and friendship.
And I suppose maybe we have to look at the fact that this was the 1980s and what was going on socially and political at that time, because any alien film that you saw up to that point was really, the Cold War was what you were looking
at. The aliens were stand-ins for the communists. And that had been the way since the 1950s. And Spielberg deliberately inverts that. This is a benign alien. He's arrived here. He literally comes in peace, as they would have said back in the day. And that was, it is almost revolutionary thinking. Mm. Not now, but it was then, that this creature would arrive and pose no threat to anybody. And all he does is spread love and joy and kindness and tries to help the people that are trying to help him and get home. It's the simplest little idea and the simplest inversion, but incredibly clever and incredibly powerful. Still, and 40 years later, yeah, Sean, it still is.
And the other thing is that it, what's vital to all of this is the fact that it is not the viewpoint of the authorities and it is not the viewpoint of those in charge that we're looking at.
It's literally told from a child's point of view. Alan Davio, who was the cinematographer that Spielberg hired to make it. Now, first of all, Davio had worked with Spielberg on his earlier short films and had gone away and made TV ads. He was a specialist in photographing TV ads. So he knew the American suburbs where the film is set intimately. He knew how to set that scene perfectly. Mm-hmm. And he put the camera down 2 feet, 3 feet lower than it would you would expect, and told the story from a child's point of view. And again, that is incredibly powerful. When you watch it now, yeah, I didn't notice it through the flood of tears 40 odd years ago, but you notice it now. It's unmistakable. That perspective is all the way through the film.
But also 40 odd years ago, you were thinking,
that's about right. That's how I see the world. Yeah,
that's where I would like the camera to be.
Spielberg had come up with the idea. He had an imaginary friend when he was a child, as his parents divorced, relatively unacrimoniously, actually, yeah, but still the separation was there and it had a huge effect on him. He was interested in making films and he was writing little stories, and he'd created this imaginary friend, and he was explaining the imaginary friend to Melissa Matheson on the set of Raiders of the Lost Ark, and she was the girlfriend of his star Harrison Ford, later became his wife, and she said, I'm going to write this as a story. And he married that to a script called Night Skies, which was the sequel to, or the proposed sequel, right, to Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And they knocked the two together. Initially, it was kind of a little scarier, apparently. The first draft of the script was a little scarier than what we see. And then they worked on it. Spielberg worked on it. And the writer and director, John Sayles, worked on it as well. But it's Matheson alone who was nominated for an Oscar. It's her name on the
nomination. I suppose what Close Encounters of the Third Kind had done, it kind of, we got the sense that, well, perhaps not all aliens are baddies. You know,
there is those elements of beauty and joy and light, which are key to Spielberg's understanding of other forces coming into this neighborhood world. And it is that Close Encounters was a globally scaled film about a global event, and E.T. is a neighborhood film, literally set in a suburb.
With the bikes on the ground.
Exactly.
Which is part of, well, there are auditions, and then there are auditions. This is the Henry Thomas audition, you know.
E.T. branded Kleenex. Yeah.
Just imagine what Spielberg must have felt.
This young lad is 8 at this stage, by the way. Yeah. He's not yet 10.
This is his audition for the part. Yeah. Incredible. In E.T. Here we go.
You can't take him away, he's mine!
But it's not my choice. The president asked me to come here and get him.
I don't care what the president says, he's my best friend! And you can't take him away!
Well, it's real possible, Elliot, that he'll come back and you can have him again. But we just want to talk to him and see where he came from and try to find out about other planets. And he probably is the key to a lot of things that we have to know.
But how do I know you're going to bring him back?
Well, I'm afraid, son, I can't guarantee it.
I think he's afraid of you.
Well, that may be true, but the government tells me what to do, and I just follow their orders.
Well, he's mine, and he lives with me, and he likes me. And he wants to stay here. He likes it here.
Well, we wouldn't hurt him or anything. All we want to do is talk to him.
But I don't want you to take him away.
Okay, Elliot.
Okay, kid, you got the job.
Okay, kid, you got the job.
Yeah,
that's Spielberg's voice at the end, and obviously Henry Thomas, who went on to play the part of Elliot on the basis of that audition, hardly surprising. Who was the casting director there?
I don't know his name. I don't know who the casting director was. That was totally improvised, by the way. They weren't reading off a script. That was just the casting, like you say, the casting director is feeding lines to the young lad and watching the young lad as he responds. It's really incredible, isn't it? It's
beyond incredible, you know, and the way he modulates there is quite extraordinary. Mike Fenton is the casting director.
No we'll call you or any of that kind of stuff. It's congrats, kids, you have the job, because, I mean, who else is he going to get? By the way, they had looked for months. They had an enormous search for this kid to play this part. And it wasn't a huge film budget that they had to play with. They only had $10.5 million which even then was a small amount of money. It's only about 30 million today. And half of that was going on special effects. Right before you did anything else, you had Carlo Rimbo had to...
And how good were those special effects, you know,
still
if you look
gorgeous,
back then?
Absolutely still gorgeous. At the time, magical. I'd never seen anything like it. But even still, they hold up today because there's the ultimate simplicity. You have the little monster, E.T., running around. They built a puppets and they had animatronics and then they had suits that smaller actors would wear. And that was simple enough. And then you basically have lights and a spaceship or the outline of a spaceship. And that's kind of it.
Yeah.
There isn't a lot. And you have, of course, the magical scene where they take off and their BMXs, which is an old movie trick and was, you know, Spielberg was very keen on that.
Are you saying that they don't actually cycle?
No, they don't actually fly. I'm sorry to burst your bubble.
What are you telling me?
So they only had, like I say, you know, 11 million to make it. And even then, that wasn't much. But this E.T., right from the moment it premiered at the Cannes Film Festival that summer, was a sensation. It was the first of these big 10-minute standing ovations. It opened in cinemas. It made a packet. I mean, it made unbelievable money. Columbia Pictures, who Spielberg had worked with for years, turned it down.
Yeah, it's like they turning down the Beatles, isn't it? We're
exactly.
In the same place.
It is exactly the same kind of case because a decade later, the Columbia Pictures shareholders produced a report that said that that decision had cost them something like $700 million.
Wow.
And that's what Universal Pictures, who had picked it up,
of course, we mentioned Henry Thomas there, but it's the kids who are at the heart of this. Very young Drew Barrymore. What age was she at this?
She was six.
Yeah,
six at the time. A scion of a venerated acting family. She was auditioned and got the part and improvised most of. Spielberg just followed her around with the camera, basically. She didn't have really lines or anything like that. She was just wandering around the set, and occasionally Gertie, the character that she plays, would say something and they'd keep it because it was pure and simple and right off the cuff. And she's wonderful in it. She really is. Thomas Howell was the older brother, and Dee Wallace, who was a veteran television actor and a scream queen from the B-movies, she plays the mother. She's literally one of the very few adults that you see.
Well, this is the scene featuring the three of the children, in fact, and the older brother. There's a little bit of mild language, but you wouldn't want your 11 or 12 year old really saying it if you were in the kitchen with him at the time. But wait till you hear what E.T. wants to do in the midst of this clip.
Phone? He said phone? Can't you understand English? He said phone.
Home?
You're right. That's E.T.'s home.
E.T. home phone.
E.T. phone home. E.T. phone home. E.T. phone home. He wants to call somebody.
What's all this shit?
E.T. phone home.
My God, he's talking.
E.T. phone home?
E.T. phone home.
Such a famous line, isn't it, from E.T.? 40 years old this year, the Steven Spielberg huge hit. And obviously Drew Barrymore, Henry Thomas in the midst of all that. But the voice of E.T.
Yeah.
How was that achieved, Joe?
Well, that was sound effects legend Ben Burtt, who utilised a variety of voices, including most famously the actress Deborah Winger. She was in there as well. And animal sounds like raccoons and horses, and he layered all of them in a mix. But he was standing in line at a laundrette somewhere in Los Angeles, and he heard this woman complaining about her shirts not being clean or whatever. And her name was Pat Walsh, and she smoked two packs of cigarettes a day, and she had this incredibly raspy voice. And he tapped her on the shoulder and said, "You're not an actor by any chance. And she had been an actor. She'd been a radio soap opera actor in the 1950s, and she got the gig. And that's, a lot of it is this woman, Pat Walsh's voice, which is kind of incredible. And E.T. is an almost silent film. There's not a huge amount of dialogue. There's not an awful lot of talk. Each element of the plot progresses through incident. Everything has meaning. Everything brings it forward. We're on a very straight line here. And Spielberg didn't have a huge amount of time to explain everything. And was, the voice that E.T. has carries a lot of his
character. Was there a sequel or was there talk of a sequel? What happened there?
There was talk of a sequel after it was nominated for 9 Oscars, including Best Film and Best Director. It didn't win them. Gandhi won Best Film. Now, we're not sitting here talking about Gandhi 40 years later. But no disrespect to Gandhi, but it won a few technical Oscars. Mm. Not long after that, Spielberg and Melissa Matheson wrote a 9-page treatment for a sequel that they called, believe it or not, E.T. 2, Nocturnal Fears.
Right.
And that didn't happen. Thankfully, now I have to say thankfully, and the follow-up would have seen Elliot and his friends and family get kidnapped and brought to space by evil aliens, and then E.T. zooms across the cosmos and comes to save them. And thankfully let us be
thankful for small mercies. Where do, when you look at it today then, John, obviously the young John Maguire in Ballinasloe has a different dynamic. What about today's generation of kids?
There is
does
a
it
legacy.
Hold up? Does it hold
up? I think it absolutely does, and this is unvarnished, uncynical emotion is key to our view of this film 40 odd years later. Virtually all previous science fiction films had grown out, like we were saying earlier, of that fear. And this was really a film about love, made and released early in the Reagan era, early in those years, at a time when American cultural values had taken a massive knock in the 60s and 70s, Watergate and the Vietnam War and all of that kind of stuff, and the oil crisis and the Iran hostage crisis. And the nation was convulsed. And in comes this little muddy, 3-foot-tall, squeaky monster and tells people to start loving each other and points his finger at his glowing heart and all that kind of stuff. And people take it. They take it on.
Right.
And it really had a massive change. And you can see that Americans are always seeking reconciliation. They're always worried about their split nation. They're always looking to try to come together and find brotherhood and unity and all that kind of stuff. But the perceived message of the times, albeit, you know, clothed in that kind of political conservatism, was one of hope and love and nostalgia. Right. Still stands today. Yeah, that's the legacy.
Is the Action Cinema still open in Ballinasloe?
No, it is not.
Well, you're going to have to bring your kids. You're going to have to bring your kids.
They won't watch it, Sean. Too scary for them. They
January
don't like
of
it.
Next year, 40 yeah. years on.
I know, they don't like it. They won't watch E.T. Too scary.
Too scary. All right. John Maguire marking the 40th anniversary of E.T. You can watch it in the cinema. There are bound to be anniversary showings, I'm sure, in the coming months. But it is available to watch on Prime Video. Irene Kelleher's new play, A Safe Passage, opens next week at Firkin Crane as part of Cork Midsummer Festival. It's New Year's Eve 1979. A Force 10 storm is approaching as Christie battens down the hatches at Inishduv Lighthouse. He's on his own. The other lighthouse keeper has gone home for an overnight visit to his wife, who's in labour, when Christie spies a woman out on the rocks, and Irene takes on the role of that woman, and Seamus O'Rourke is Christie. And delighted to say that Irene Kelleher joins us now from our Cork studio. I'll come to the play in a minute, but let's talk a little bit about the lighthouse. Is such a, it's such an evocative building, in a lighthouse in the first place. Irene, you have always had an interest in lighthouses. It goes right back to childhood, I believe.
That's right. Lighthouses were always a source of wonder and inspiration and awe, I suppose, for me. My grandmother was from Feanit Lighthouse, or from Feanit. So we used to go out, we used to go to Kerry on holidays, and every summer I'd go out with my parents. We'd walk along Feanit Strand and look across at the lighthouse, but you couldn't get out there. And because I couldn't get out there, it made it all the more enticing, and I used to imagine, well, what's it like inside? And I was always kind of obsessed with stories about lighthouses. They were always ghostly and strange and mysterious. So that's kind of where it began in childhood, really.
You've been writing this play for years, it sounds like.
Exactly.
But you did finally then, you got to stay in a lighthouse in 2016. This was on Clare Island off the coast of Mayo. Now, I think that was really what set the ball rolling in terms of A Safe Passage. Is it safe to say that?
Absolutely. I mean, I hadn't intended on looking for inspiration for a play or anything like that. We just went on a holiday and the weather was terrible. It was August. It was raining all the time. So we were stuck inside the lighthouse. Now, it was a beautiful place to be stuck inside because it's almost better in bad weather, because the atmosphere and hearing the howling wind, it's really inspirational. But while I was there, I was reading some of the journals of former lighthouse keepers that were there, just to pass the time, really. But there was one particular line that really got to me, and it was from a keeper of, I think he was probably 100 years ago, but he was stationed on a rock lighthouse, and he said he prayed the whole time he was there that not a soul came to visit him the whole time he was stationed on the rock. And I just thought, what is his story? Like, why did he seek that kind of isolation? And also the use of the word soul.
Yeah.
I know it was a different time, but I just thought, well, why is he saying soul? And that sentence just kind of haunted me. And I just left it kind of sit in my brain. As I said, I wasn't thinking about writing a new play at the time, but I kept going back to that and imagining what kind of man he was and why he wanted to be isolated and be so alone. And he also wrote about while he was stationed on the rock alone, he could hear the clinking of glasses on the mainland from the pub. And I was just imagining that of being isolated and alone, but hearing, you know, community and people together. And I just, it was really that sentence that kind of brought me into
Of course, because what essentially we have is we have this character of Christy, the lighthouse keeper, who's in the lighthouse by himself and set up in that scenario. When this, when literally a soul does appear to him, this is a young woman. You're playing the character of the young woman as well. There's a kind of, well, actually, do you know what? We'll talk about some of the kind of mythology around that in a second, because let's listen to a clip where Christy at this stage has brought the young woman into the lighthouse. And not surprisingly, he's a little bit unnerved by the mysterious woman. But then she produces a pack of tarot cards. Do you really want that in a lighthouse? I'm not sure. Let's have a listen to how that clip proceeds then. And it's Seamus O'Rourke as Christy and yourself, Irene Kelleher, as the woman.
Know why he's the most powerful of all the cards? The Joker. The fool, but don't be fooled. This card means unlimited potential. It's a simultaneous beginning and an ending. It's a risk, but a risk worth taking. It's the age-old question of, should you take a leap of faith? Will it bring fortune or folly? In tarot, the fool stands on the edge of a sea cliff, carefree and smiling. Sound familiar?
There's no truth in it.
Truth? That's a good one. Have you no faith?
Faith? No. Above all other things, I can say with certainty, I have no faith.
But you believe in God.
I have more belief in that Joker than God, or in all your card hocus pocus.
And that's Seamus O'Rourke as Christy and Irene Kelleher as the woman who's reading the tarot cards in Irene's play A Safe Passage, which is opening next week at Firk and Crane as part of Cork Midsummer Festival. And we get a sense of it there, really, in that clip, Irene, that there is a kind of an otherworldly thing going on. I suppose it's there in mythology, isn't it? This idea of the woman who appears on the rocks to the lighthouse keeper or to, and sometimes it's to the sailors on a ship or whatever. Yeah. Were you picking up on that type of those older folk tales?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's steeped in kind of Celtic mythology, especially that legend of the siren, the strange, mysterious woman, usually on the rocks, who calls fishermen and lighthouse keepers to their death, and they appear to lighthouse keepers before they die. Well, it's steeped in mythology, but also there's that true case of the Flannel Isles off the coast of Scotland, where three lighthouse keepers disappeared at the turn of the 20th century, and it was said that one of them saw a woman before. I mean, it's all this kind of legends about, I suppose, a strange woman causing the demise of a man and leading him to his death. So that's in, I would say, 8 out of 10 stories about lighthouses.
Yeah, that story of the three, that became an opera, Peter Maxwell Davies' opera.
That's
didn't
right.
It? The Lighthouse, simply called The Lighthouse. Had you seen, looked at other kind of stories around the lighthouse or lighthouses?
Yeah, so when I decided, okay, I'm a bit obsessed with this character and this idea of this man who wants to isolate himself, I started research into lighthouses just to see where it was going, and I read books, and there were so many short stories and radio plays as well, because it's so atmospheric about lighthouses. And that story kept coming back about the, you know, the siren leading, calling the man to his demise. But what I was really more interested in is, okay, if it is also steeped in reality, and what happens if two people who are, you know, completely different in different ages and completely different personalities are thrown together in a place that you can't leave. And they both have, in A Safe Passage, they have very distinct plans for the evening, and they both disrupt their plans. And but also they also want the same thing. So it's that sort of battle of who's saving who, and what if you save somebody who doesn't want to be saved. So a kind of, I steeped it in reality then. I had read all the legends and did a lot of research about lighthouses, but it was really when I got talking to a former lighthouse keepers that I got a real sense of what it was like to live there, and kind of away from the fantasies and the stories and what day-to-day working life is there. So I eventually got to stay in one to write the play.
Wow. So you went back, you haven't had the holiday in 2016. You went back to write the play in a lighthouse itself.
That's right. So I was on tour with Gone Full Havisham, which I think I was talking to you about a few years ago.
This is your one woman show.
That's right. That's right. Modern day Miss Havisham. And that I had a break in the month of March 2020, which obviously means a lot to us now. But I knew I had downtime then, and I'd a busy year or so, I thought, for the rest of the year. So I took time off to write the play. And I thought, well, if I'm taking time off to write, why don't I look at staying in a lighthouse and write it? Because I got so much inspiration from Clare Island Lighthouse. So I contacted Irish Landmark Trust, who organise accommodation for people who want to stay in lighthouses. And I, you know, said I was a writer. So I got a writer's residency. And I'd planned on staying there a little while. And as part of my research, one of the books I read was Gerald Butler's book, The Lightkeeper, who was a former keeper at Galleyhead and many other places. And he was actually the house manager there, because he was stationed there for so long. So I was very excited when I got to meet him in person, and really then being there. And again, March, it was terrible weather, and listening to the howling wind. And but more than anything, listening to Gerald's stories, because I really found out listening to him what it was like. He was stationed for a long time at the Fastnet Lighthouse, which is the mother of all lighthouses. It's in the middle of absolutely nowhere. And he explained what it was like being in the light tower when a storm was raging and the waves going over the tower, and the hairs were standing up on the back of my neck. And I just thought, but it was there, actually, I found that the story of it, because up until then, I thought it was going to be a one-man show. It's going to be Christy's story. But then, see, the pandemic hit, lockdown hit. So lockdown hit when I was staying in the lighthouse. And that sense of the isolation a lighthouse keeper would feel and all that suddenly came into the fore.
And not difficult to isolate, I guess. But one final question, Irene. Because you're very specific about this being New Year's Eve 1979. Why that particular New Year's Eve, 3 years before E.T. that we were talking about?
That's true. Yeah. I think, how am I going to follow E.T.? So it's 1979 because in the 1980s, all lighthouses were automated. So it was a huge period of change for lighthouse keepers. They knew that, you know, their jobs as they were going to be, they're going to lose them, and life was going to change. And also going into the decade of the 80s, and also there's always that feeling of hope. But also it was October 1979, the Pope's visit to Ireland, and there's a lot of discussion about faith in the play as well. But New Year's Eve is because there's a lot of grief in the play. I think our director, Jeff Gould, summed it up lovely. He said it's ghosts, grief and guilt. And New Year's Eve, I think, after a loss and after grief, is kind of one of the worst nights of the year, because you're facing into, you're leaving a year, you're going into another year without the person, you're leaving a last year behind. And so that's why it's New Year's Eve.
I suppose Passage and Safe Passage has several meanings when you start explaining it in that way. Lovely to speak with you this evening, Irene. Thanks for telling us about A Safe Passage. That's Irene's play featuring herself, her own writing, obviously, and then herself and Seamus O'Rourke as the two actors in A Safe Passage at the Firkin Crane as part of Cork Midsummer Festival from the 17th through until the 21st of June. And you can find out full details on corkmidsummer.com. And we finish the week, as always, with album reviews. First up, George Ezra released his first album in 2014, reached number one in the UK, a feat repeated with his second album in 2018, and that was quickly followed by the Brit Award the following year for Best British Male Solo Artist. Album number three arrives today. It's called Gold Rush King. Will this be his third chart topper? Next up, Irish punk poet, as she's widely called, Sinead O'Brien. She was with us on the programme here back in January of last year. A string of really well-received singles. But this Sunday, she shares the stage with Goldfrapp and Duran Duran at St Anne's Park in Dublin. And that's part of her nine country tour in support of her debut album, Time Bend and Break the Bar, which is out today. And finally, Vance Joy, born James Gabriel Keogh. The Australian singer and songwriter has been huge critical and commercial success in his native land since his debut album was released in 2014. He's been spreading his wings internationally, including as an opening act for Pink on her 2019 world tour. In Our Own Sweet Time is the title of his third album. Paul McLoone and Andrea Clary have been listening to the albums for us. We'll start with George Ezra. Gold Rush Kid is the title of the album. This is the title track.
Rock, paper, scissors, I play against the mirror. There hasn't been a winner for 9 days straight. I went to see the doctor, she cut open my head. Took a look inside and this is what she said. Boy, you're not alone, although you feel alone. You're just like everyone, you're holding on. I'm the Gold Rush Kid, robbing the bank, making a run for it and learning to dance. I'm the Gold Rush Kid, robbing the bank, making a run for it and learning to dance. Watching me now.
Kid, the name of the song and the title of the third album from British singer-songwriter George Ezra. Typically upbeat, very happy, very positive slice of pop there, and the first of our three albums up for review this evening. Paul McLoone and Andrea Clary are with me in studio this evening. Nobody popping, nobody's head going up and down, and I'm thinking
inside I'm popping.
Yeah, it's lashing rain outside, you know, for 1 minute, and then yeah, the sun is shining the next minute. Now there, that'll keep you in a summery mood, would it not, Paul?
Probably not me, no, but you know, I'm funny that way.
A great singer.
He is a great singer, and I was probably going to make this point in conclusion, but I think he's kind of making not the wrong records, because they're clearly very successful records for him. But I'd love to hear him do something. He cites as his influences Leadbelly and Dylan and guys like that, kind of rootsy, sort of bluesy stuff. And he's got the perfect voice for that. I'd love to hear him do more of that stuff. This stuff's fine. It's very much kind of assembled to cater to the audience that have made his first two albums such successes. And this one, no doubt, will follow suit. You know, it just kind of leaves me a bit cold. I think there's a couple of more interesting moments where he does get a little more introspective and things do take a turn for the slightly darker later on in the record, where I actually find that more interesting, which possibly says more about me than him. But
I find it interesting that you used the word that you said that the album was assembled.
Now, that's
a loaded term, I would have thought. You weren't bopping your head and bouncing up and down too much to that, Andrea.
No, I think assembled is the exact correct word. It does. It's assembly line, production, songwriting, chord progressions. The only interesting thing really about this is George Ezra's voice, and there's sort of nothing he can do about that at this stage. I completely agree. He's not singing the right songs. The songs he is singing are about positivity, dancing, collectivism, having a good time, but not even taking those topics to interesting places. It's just, sure, aren't we all here? We might as well have a dance.
And who is he writing the songs, or is there a whole assembly line?
He wrote the majority of the songs, and he had a bit of help on one or two, I think, but they are majority him. He studied songwriting at BIM in Bristol. So he does have a kind of a history of songwriting, but whether I would give him an A if I was his tutor, I don't know.
He does have a bit of a co-conspirator. I think a guy used to be an athlete.
Yes.
Is kind of giving him a hand on
that. Who loved a great beat to run to,
clearly. Well, that's it.
But, you know, you can't get away from the quality of the production. I know you're saying assembled. It's a very loaded term. But this is really clean, easy listening.
It is. And it has its place. And, you know, these are tropes. These things that Andrea was just mentioning there that aren't, let's face it, specific to George Ezra. There seems to be a general market for this kind of inclusive, upbeat, optimistic. And I'm not saying that doesn't have its place in pop music. It's there to entertain and there to bring people joy. But, you know, obviously that's true. But I think there's a kind of a slightly shallow meaninglessness to a lot of these kind of songs. They all tend to kind of obey the same rules. They all tend to come from the same sort of sonic box, if you like, and I just find it after a while a little, indistinct. Actually, I can't. Okay. You know, if it wasn't for his immediately recognisable voice, it could almost be any singer.
But as you suggested, Paul, maybe towards the latter half of the album, it does get a little bit more introspective. And let's have a listen to a song called "Sweetest Human Being Alive" and see if we find out anything more about George Ezra the person.
Somewhere out there is my girl, my future flame. I save the date, my come to bed now, for heaven's sakes. And I just cannot wait to meet my girl. We'll dance by the light of the moon in the sky. We'll sail on through forever for a while. You'll tell your friends and I'll tell mine. Well, goodness gracious, what a time. I found the sweetest human being alive. Ooh, I can't wait to meet you, babe. Can't wait to love you, babe. Can't wait to meet you, babe. Can't wait to love you, babe.
So, Andrea Cleary, are you running out to meet George Ezra? Are you moved by that kind of open-heartedness?
I don't remember the last time I was as unmoved as I currently am. Maybe the last time I listened to the song. This song was really genuinely one of the most kind of cynical moments on the album for me. I found it really quite sickening. I hated it. I thought it was going to be about a baby, because I kind of feel like you can only get away with calling somebody the sweetest human being alive if it's your son or daughter. Otherwise, no, deeply unmoved by this, and incredibly formulaic and written for a wedding, and really hate it.
It's pretty nauseating, isn't it? It's not the track I was alluding to. There is a track called "I Went Hunting," which I think is quite a personal song. And of all the songs on the album, it's the only one that actually rang true with me. Because I think he's talking about his own personal sort of issues with mental health and stuff, which is, you know, not something I was expecting to hear in the middle of this particular record, to be honest. So, you know, I'll give him a point for that.
Okay, well, I don't know if George will be depending on Stars From Us to get the sales. I said they'd say he'll do okay, but Stars From You on this one, Paul?
I would give us 2.5.
2.5 out of 5, and Andrea?
It's more run-of-the-mill pop, but it sounds fine, I guess. 2 stars.
It sounds fine, I guess. I can see that on the back of the album when they want to get the stars out there. All right, let's move on then to Sinead O'Brien, "Time Bend and Break the Bower." As I said, she's on stage this Sunday evening at St Anne's Park in Raheny in Dublin, supporting Duran Duran, and also in support of her debut album. And that album is called "Time Bend and Break the Bower." Let's have a listen to a track called "Salt."
Hopes are hard as rock here, a sacrifice in the name of heat. Hopes are all I've got pinned on diamonds. Stretch my body out before the sky comes down. Stretch my palms out to the farthest stars. Burn my shoes in the sand. Salt myself in crystals. Preserve some of the music. I have a godlike desire to lie down in the street. Let the waters of the gutters run right over me. Sky break open, pour it down. have the wind that moves me. For when the world ends and someone will sing the last song, someone dreams the first hymn, when the world will spin again. What the song says to the sound.
Salt, the title of that track from Sinead O'Brien and her new album Time Bend and Break the Bower. Andrea, I spoke with Sinead O'Brien early last year, and even at that stage a lot of people had her on the one to watch list, you know. 9 singles she had over 3 years then. Just give us a little bit of her background and her career up until this point.
Yeah, so I mean, she started writing poetry. She was a poet first. After she graduated from college, she'd moved to Paris, and she started to get into this habit of listening to music while she wrote. So the music was always there, but she didn't have a band. She didn't play music herself at the time. So the music was always part of the poetry. She just didn't have a band. And I mean, there's a kind of a, that's a little bit of a trend at the moment. I mean, a band that come up a lot when you talk about Sinead O'Brien and the current sort of post-punk spoken word thing is Dry Cleaning. Their lead vocalist, Florence Shaw, would have kind of come up in very much the same way. But from there, it was just string after string of really, really critically acclaimed singles. But I really feel like with this album, she's arrived and she has, you know, this is a mission statement from her, and it's strong.
And Andrea touched on it there, because we are talking about this kind of post-punk type of spoken word. And we're not necessarily talking about, you know, often the spoken word, we might attach it to some kind of activism or some kind of political content in the lyrics. The background as a poet, I think, is probably more important here. That the lyrics aren't as straightforward. They're more imagistic. They're more opaque.
Certainly quite elliptical, actually. And you know, to me, just listening to it, I think I need to spend a bit more time with this record, if I'm honest. You know, I've listened to it a couple of times, but I think, which is a good thing about an album, you know, that the lyrics are kind of occasionally, it's like a torrent of words. There's so much of it going on, and not all of that goes in straight away. You've got to kind of live with it for a while. I think you've got to really familiarise yourself with it and let it play in your own subconscious to a degree as well, for layers of whatever meaning you might infer from it.
What about how she's matching, or how the music and the poetry are melding together? How is she managing, or how well is she doing with that, Andrea?
Yeah, I mean, there's times when she's pretty arrhythmic, where the music is doing a completely different thing to her, and that's not a bad thing, I don't think, because in the current trend of kind of spoken word post-punk, there is a sort of matching up rhythmically of the vocals and the music. So when she does kind of veer off course a bit, it's usually for the right reasons. It's usually for some kind of emotional heft, and it keeps you awake, it keeps you alert, and you're like, oh, this is going somewhere where it's not supposed to. But then there's other times where she's almost singing, and her almost singing voice is really pleasant and really, really sweet.
That almost singing is there in the second track that I wanted to play, and it's also one where I suppose the tempo isn't quite as steady a beat as you might expect from a spoken word type of situation. This is Multitudes.
If I must look on every blessed thing and sing the praises, praise the honest thing, a baby for angel wings, and let the rain come down in showers. The way the blessed things give meaning to the hours. Then I must be a singer, set me free, let me sing, let me make a song for all the things I look upon. And praise the ladies all in waiting, waiting for an knolling bell to toll, all things still. In patience, praise the honest thing, a babe before angel wings. Praise the honest thing, annihilation on my tail, time stretch and bend the bower. In ridicules, the clocks remain, promise not to stretch the hours, time bend and break the bower.
the title of the album within that song, Multitudes, Time Bend and Break the Bar, from Sinead O'Brien. I wouldn't pretend for one second that I would, that you can get the, you'll understand those lyrics on a first listening.
Yeah.
But there's something kind of pulls you in some way, doesn't it, Paul?
There is something very compelling about how she puts those words together. And I guess, you know, she's coming at it from a poetry angle, so that's probably not a surprise, but it really does make for a very intriguing mix. I actually prefer it when the band, the backing track and the vocal do gel a little more conventionally musically for me. Maybe I'm just old fashioned, but I did find a bit of a distraction, a disconnect maybe to an extent when it just seems to be too disparate between the two things. There doesn't seem to be any kind of kinetic connection between the two in places. It's a minor criticism though, because it's obviously very distinctive and she's really quite unique despite the prevalence of all this sort of spoken word stuff at the minute. I think she really has her own niche there.
Yeah, and we all spoke in studio about PJ Harvey, Patti Smith, yeah. All of those influences are in there, Andrea.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I even feel a bit of kind of Sinead O'Connor in the spirit of it. It's quite, there's moments that are quite witchy and mystical, but then there's other moments like the song Like Culture, which are lyrics that she wrote when she was 17, just about a night out and how it feels to be on a night out with your friends. And she kind of, you know, transforms it into this almost like pagan ritualistic thing, which I absolutely love. I think that's great. Right.
Yeah. This album worked for you, I think, fairly clearly. What are you saying in terms of stars for Time Bend and Break the Bar for Sinead O'Brien, Andrea?
Yeah, for me, it's 4 stars. I think it's really strong.
And Paul?
I go 3.5. Funnily enough, I find some of the tracks that I preferred to be located sort of towards the end of the album. I struggled a little with the early part of the album. So 3.5 for now, probably 4 next week.
Though. Right, you have to have another few listens to go there. All right, let us move on to album number 3, Vance Joy, In Her Own Sweet Time. Third album from this Australian singer-songwriter born James Gabriel Keogh. He must have a bit of Irish in him. Now, will we want to claim it or not? Let's have a listen.
I could hold you like this all day. Didn't get much sleep, that's okay. Not a single thing needs to change. We can be the light that don't fade away.
Taste of the opening. Yes, it is the opening track on Vance Joy's new album, In Our Sweet Time. I questioned as to whether we want to claim James Gabriel Keogh as Irish or not. Do not answer that question just yet, Paul McLoone.
Okay.
He's Australian, hugely successful in his native land. Is he branching out now? How successful is he, I suppose?
Well, he had
how successful would he be?
He had a massive hit with a track called Riptide.
Nearly a decade.
Yeah, well, it's a good while ago now. Yeah. He must be getting on. He must be nearly 30. but yeah, I mean, this, for me, it just kind of, as I mentioned earlier, that sort of really narrow set of kind of parameters that a lot of this music seems to operate within. And I think this is just another example of it. I think it's got a lot in common with the George Ezra record, only he doesn't have anywhere near as distinctive a voice as our friend George. Mm. And actually, if anything, it is the treatment of the voice on this record that irks me the most. It's just this consistent sort of processed sound that just seems to be there the whole time. And I don't think there's any actual need for it. I think he can sing perfectly well, but just the producers have decided in their wisdom to kind of coat everything in this slightly synthetic sheen. And I think the tracks could actually benefit from a bit of stripping back on that score. You know.
And what are we hearing? What are the songs about? Vance Joy may be a giveaway. Is that Joy a bit of a giveaway there, Andrea?
No, I think, I mean, we were talking outside before we started recording, and I said I'm really getting tired of men with guitar singing about their girlfriends, and this is another album of that. You know, it's not, there's really, it's incredibly inoffensive. It's got simple chord progressions. It's very obvious instrumental choices. There's a ukulele at one point. And I mean, if we're talking about this in terms of, you know, we also didn't really like the George Ezra album, but George Ezra, like it or not, at least sounds current.
Voice,
this
yeah.
this style of music yeah. went out a decade ago. And lyrically, it's still going.
I do have to ask who advised him to rhyme Hey Catalonia with I Was Just Getting to Know You. That is actually a lyric on the album.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Yeah. But I mean, there's so many moments in the album where the lyrics are, you know, when I'm in a room with you, that missing piece is found. When the seas were rising up, I had one thing in mind. It was you.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know,
that's the one that's made it to Grey's Anatomy.
Yeah.
Tellingly.
But what seas are rising up in your world, Vance Joy? What is it that you're trying to fight against? Because we don't get it at all here.
Well, let's see how he feels about daylight.
We were walking arm in arm through Barcelona. There were people singing opera in the streets. And I kiss you by the fountain in the square. A part of my heart will always be there. Just wanted you to know the times I feel helpless. Nothing but dark skies on the nights that seem endless. You are like daylight, babe. You are like daylight, babe.
There you go. You are like daylight, babe. Would that not send you back to or over to Barcelona for a romantic evening by the fountain
over
in the square?
Yeah, Sean, I'll tell you that. Yeah, this is just, it's so formulaic and so kind of banal, and there's nothing interesting about it, you know, musically, lyrically, sonic. There's just nothing. It's kind of, for me, it's just sort of nothing music. You know, it makes George Ezra sound like Radiohead.
For me, it was the upbeat songs were written for ads, and the more stripped back downbeat songs were written for first dances at weddings. And those are the two routes that this
very
album
hard
has.
On weddings and first dances.
I've been to two in the past week, so I've heard a lot of this kind of music.
I think you might be literally right about that.
Yeah,
I really do.
So.
I hope your friends won't mind you mentioning that. However, let us finish up then with poor Vance. In our own
Sorry,
sweet
Vance.
Time. So in your own sweet time, give me the stars, Andrea Cleary, for Vance Joy.
Look, for the two diehard fans that he might have out there, they will like this. But for everyone else, I would recommend giving it a miss. I'm going to give it 1.5 stars.
1.5. Paul?
Yeah. It is what it is, but what it is something I can't stand. But I will give it 2 because I know a lot of people out there, for reasons I can't fathom, really love this sort of stuff. So fair play to them. I'll give it 2.
All
it's fine
right.
on its own terms.
I think we know Vance Joy in our own sweet time, George Ezra, Gold Rush Kid, and Sinead O'Brien, Time Bend and Break the Bar. I think I know which one the two of you will be listening to more over the coming days and weeks. Andrea Cleary and Paul McLoone are reviewers on this Friday evening. And Andy's our lot for this Friday, indeed for this week here in Arena. Liam Murphy and Paul De Shields researched. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Ashton Grufferty was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan. I will speak to you once again on Monday when among our guests will be the double Oscar winning Emma Thompson, talking to us about her new film, taboo breaking new film. Really interesting stuff indeed. That is on Monday evening. In the meantime, have a great weekend, and John Creedon will be with you after the 8 o'clock news.